Like, I don't think, men should live up to those expectations. I think it's defined differently. And from a standpoint of just certain behaviors, to say a man is not supposed to have a manicure or like pink or, cook or do certain qualities because that's a gender role. We supposed to me, we supposed to teach life skills, not gender roles. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I personally don't subscribe to it. And as a matter of fact, I'm manicured up. Like I take care of myself.
And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/MrChaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own questions. Be a part of it for as low as $5 a month and get access to one-on-one coaching with me for as low as $20 a month.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people who can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I have a little bit of a different episode for you guys, and we're talking about men's mental health. And let me just have the person come in and introduce themselves, and we'll jump right into the conversation. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Chaz, listen, appreciate you for having me. How y'all doing out there? My name is James Harris. I'm a father, veteran, entrepreneur, therapist, and I'm also the founder of a movement called Men to Heal, which focuses on men's overall wellness, our mental health, physical health, and of course, our emotional health. I'm also the author of a book called Man, Just Express Yourself, which is an interactive planner guide for boys and men to better express themselves, those tough conversations that often aren't held. And I also created a board game called Cheesy Dates, which is a good interactive tool for adults, couples, anybody, regardless of what stage of your relationship you're in, you can take some away from it.
Oh, awesome. Cool. So what kind of brought you to this space of men's mental health? Like, why is that something that you said you've written books? Like, why is that something that you're investing your time in? Why does it matter?
Overall mental health matters for not just men, but specifically to your question, I think men's mental health is important because oftentimes there's a lack in that service, a lack of, the accountability piece, a lack of the positive representation within the field. I mean, my personal journey was I was a ward of the state. I was in foster care and group home, and therapy was mandatory at that time. And it wasn't any therapist who looked like me. And it just wasn't a pleasant experience. And, growing up now, being older, joined the military, 2 deployments, 1 Iraq, 1 Afghanistan, and tried therapy again, and it was the same thing. And that's part of the reason why a lot of veterans tend to go to groups opposed to individual therapy. So I just took it upon myself to do some research, and then I was like, oh man, this is something I got to do. I got to change this narrative, not only for the men, but for the young boys or for pretty much a lot of different people. So I got me a bachelor's in clinical psychology. Then I got a master's in clinical mental health counseling and started my licensure journey. So when I started in private practice, it was a woman-owned practice, and they do phenomenal work in the community. So I was like, oh man, we got to do something for the men. So, but before that, like while in grad school, I had this assignment, like if it was one population that you can work with, who would it be type thing. And, a couple of people from my cohort was only 3 males. I was the only black male, and there was 8, women, Caucasian women and a Hispanic woman. So, the diversity. Level, I just was like, oh man, men are oftentimes left out as far as just overall, and then of course you got the societal stigmas of what vulnerability equating to weakness or what men should or shouldn't do, the roles of masculinity, all those things. So I took that on as assignment. A couple of people in the cohort, of course, they took women's rights, LGBTQ rights, veterans. You know, initially I chose veterans too, but then I was like, oh man, the men are often left out. So let me, you know, do the research on that. So I did it, and it was a fun project. I enjoyed it, just interviewing different people, different men, different partners, you know, talking about the husband, not getting physicals, not talking about it, not opening up. Of course, the parents of young sons. And it just grew, man. I was just fascinated with it. So I started putting together these seminars within my community and my art gallery. And, you know, the turnout just was phenomenal. It was 20 people show up, and then 40 people, then 60 people. And it was all in topics in relations to men and mental health. You know, I have different speakers and panelists coming in, and it just continued to grow because the universality of it all, like a lot of different people in different places was like, oh man, my dad can use this, or my uncle can use this, or a man just come up like, oh man, I didn't know this was available. We talk in a barbershop, or we talk XYZ, but I didn't know, you know, so that just continued to grow, man. It manifested itself into, of course, the book, and then the YouTube channel, and then just helping people on social media with the inboxes and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm just fortunate to be in a position to use my personal experience and my willingness to help to have people gravitate to it. And here we are.
Wow, that's powerful. So there's a statistic that I read that said 50% of men who have mental health challenges will not go seek help. And that's a pretty large percentage. And I'm wondering if you kind of know why that is, or you can kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, the wild thing is that statistic, that number is probably even higher. That's like the reported number. You know what I'm saying? It's a handful of them that's probably didn't do the survey or don't, you know, report to those statistics. But just based on a lot of different things from a societal standpoint, you know, men can't or don't have enough spaces to where they can report how they feel often without being chastised or demonized for being, you know, less than or weak. And then, of course, in a lot of different is generationally, you know, traditionally from a standpoint, men often which is where a thing, you know, without revealing what's wrong until it's that time to explode, or it manifests itself in relationships or in school or at work or whatever the case is. So I think from an overall standpoint, it has done a disservice to not only the older men, but the younger men, because these cycles are still being repeated to this day. So, you know, we have to continue to break those cycles and allow people, specifically men, to feel validated and allow them to be vulnerable. And, you know, society should accept it without putting strings on it, without putting limitations on it, because once we evolve from what a man is supposed to be figuratively, and, you know, it'll be better for not only the men, the boys themselves, but the people vicariously around those men. You know, like, it's okay to express emotion and feelings and have like human qualities, opposed to just being this mythical creature that's supposed to be stoic and bold all the time. And, you know, just take all of this stuff and wear it without, you know, relinquishing himself. So, you know, once we do that, that's where we are. But from a traditional standpoint, from a religious standpoint too, in some religions, you know, the man is supposed to be a certain way. So a lot of things can contribute to why men don't, you know, seek help or just express themselves in a healthier way, I would suggest. But, you know, it's a couple of different things. Some of it is personal. Some of it is living up to the expectation of others. And then some of it is a couple of the reasons that I just mentioned.
Okay. So what if you're like a friend or a partner, or, you know, you're someone who know someone who is struggling with mental health, and maybe they know it, maybe they don't, but they're not willing to get help, or they don't know they need help. Like, how do you, as a friend or as a partner, how do you like help that person? What do you do? Because I mean, I'm sure if you like just, I don't know, I can see it being approached if you approach it in a certain way, that it will shut someone off even more, and they'll get defensive, they'll take offense to it, and then, you know, maybe they'll lash out or they'll just disconnect from you. And so how do you approach that as a partner, as a friend, to really be helpful?
So to be honest with you, man, it's like the number one question that wives or girlfriends come to me with, like, hey, I want my, you know, man, boyfriend, son, or whatever to get assistance, but like, I don't want to feel overwhelmed and I don't want to do X, Y, Z. I don't want them to be mad, or I don't want them to think. So, you know, I tell them two things, to be honest with you, even if we're in session together, like marriage counseling or family counseling, I tell them, you know, I can't assist anybody who don't want help, nor can I assist anybody who don't see an issue with their actions. And I then tell them, that lady or that parent or spouse or partner, you know, do what you can as far as support, but don't drain yourself emotionally. Don't put yourself in a situation to where it can be abusive for you, not only just physical, but of course, emotionally draining. But I would say, you know, model a certain thing. You know, if you model a certain behavior, they'll probably gravitate to that and see like, oh man, they're on this playing field. They're doing mindfulness, or they're not as upset as they used to be. What are they doing? So you can do it that way. And it, also you can, you know, I encourage them to do a little bit of research as far as, hey, I found this website that might benefit you. You know, it's about stress, or it's about some of the behaviors that you probably been displaying. Or, hey, have you heard of this group? You know, and just do research. Or this is a good book. That was my primary reason for writing the book, too, is so wives can give it to their husband and it doesn't feel like a chore to them. You know what I'm saying? It feels like a way to enhance that relationship, opposed to it feeling like that man is being overwhelmed. So ideally, the wife or the parent would give this book to the male in their life. They'll highlight a couple chapters, give it to them, and allow that male to do the chapters that they highlighted. Then they process it together. So, you know, he can answer their questions and get the answers and feedback that they want. And it's been very beneficial that way that I found. So I definitely continue to say, though, like, do what's best for you in those situations. Like, try to encourage them and help them. But if it's going to put you in a situation to where it's going to become cantankerous or potentially abusive, then just fall back. Just let them know, like, hey, these are your actions. You know, like, I don't know if you're noticing these actions, but they're affecting me. They're affecting our relationship. You know, this can't continue to go on. So try to navigate it from that approach. And if they still don't make changes or acknowledge the fact that it's creating issues, then, you know, sadly, you may have to distance yourself or create a plan to potentially allow them to do it on their own.
So like, a couple of things that I heard there was model the healthy habits so that they may kind of, they see it and they may like catch on, that may even open up conversations. The other thing that I heard you say is share resources with them. You know, no matter, it could be a book, it could be a group, it could be a lot of different things, but share resources. And then kind of the third thing that I heard you say is like, is to try to, you know, at some point do have a conversation and share how you're feeling and how it's impacting you, and try to have that kind of healthy conversation so that maybe they're not even aware of it, or they're only aware of it to a certain extent, and they don't know how serious it is to you. And so did I get that right?
You did. And I would touch on the first one too. The first one you mentioned, as far as, you know, what was the first one you said just now?
I think I said modeling healthy habits.
And that right there, to me, is one of the most important ones, because oftentimes, you know, when somebody is met with resistance or conflict, naturally they want to add to the conflict. Like, if it's an argument or a confrontation, they want to get that point across. But if they just, you know, do what they're supposed to do, or do what is healthy for them, or do what they can control, then the other person might, one, they can't argue by themselves, or they can't create the conflict by themselves. So they would view it as, what, you know, why they didn't give me the attention or the satisfaction of, you know, my actions toward them. So they probably have pushed them to that last limit. Or what am I doing, you know, that was so offensive that this person, you know, so those things are definitely helpful. And then, of course, the resources are a big one, because then, you know, they can do their own research and they might see themselves in some of the research that they're referring to, you know, and that can be, different groups or, again, different books or, you know, just different people or different ideas of what you think this person is displaying. You know, you can suggest, I would suggest sending them the research based on that, or, you know, just do what's best for you in those situations. But it's definitely important that the last one you said was address it. You have to address it at some point, because if not, then you will continue to be overwhelmed and putting yourself in those situations. So now you're drained all the time. Your energy is not as high as it could be. The relationship is continue to be detrimental, you know, regardless of where it is. Like, you're now in this position to where, like, this is taking a toll on me, you know? So of course you got to do what's best for you in that situation.
Yeah. So I want to actually almost take a, I don't know if this is a step back or step forward, but I want to talk about masculinity for a moment. And there's a really popular term that is being, that's used right now as to describe toxic masculinity. And I want to know what your thoughts are on toxic masculinity. What is it? And what is healthy masculinity? Right. And I want to just kind of hear what your thoughts are on that as it pertains to masculinity.
Yeah. So to be honest with you, I mean, I personally don't subscribe to the talks or the thoughts of what masculinity is supposed to be as far as being toxic or positive. I just think from a societal standpoint, I understand within the last couple of years, it's been this phenomenon of, you know, what the cultural said it is. But like, I don't think, you know, men should live up to those expectations. I think it's defined differently. And from a standpoint of just certain behaviors, to say a man is not supposed to have a manicure or like pink or, you know, cook or do certain qualities because that's a gender role. You know, we supposed to, me, we supposed to teach life skills, not gender roles. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I personally don't subscribe to it. And as a matter of fact, I'm manicured up. Like, I take care of myself. You know what I'm saying? My favorite color is pink. And, you know,
so I need to get a manicure.
So for me, I don't subscribe to it. But I would say healthy, you know, if we want to go there, healthy masculinity is not suggesting that being tough is equated to manhood, or having certain power dynamics is equated to manhood. Those things, you know, because again, those things contribute to not only the masculine side of society, but of course the overall oppression of society, if you want to be honest with you, you know what I'm saying? Like, from a historical standpoint. So to me, those conversations should be had, but they also detrimental, because people don't realize that they're contributing to it. I mean, even women contribute to it, and they probably don't realize it too on a micro level. You know, like, I've witnessed women or parents say, like, oh no, I'm not gonna let my son play with an easy bake oven. And then I've, you know, observed those same women upset when they meet a partner who don't cook. You know what I'm saying? Like, how ironic is that? Like, they're not even subconsciously knowing, like, you're telling this young boy, your son, to not play with an easy bake oven or do these specific chores. But then in your relationship, you want a man to cook for you and clean up, you know? So that's ironic. That's why I say I don't subscribe to it, because I've seen such an ironic situations just being a therapist, you know? So I'm always throwing those questions back to the people, you know? And of course, those things can stem from different childhood issues, parenting styles or attachment styles. So those things are important. But from an overall standpoint, though, masculinity itself shouldn't be defined as toxic or healthy. It should just be a specific term, you know, just like feminist. But I don't think it should be a catalyst for what a man should be. You know what I'm saying? Like, those specific criteria shouldn't be, like, a man shouldn't be chastised for, again, like, human qualities as opposed to gender roles or societal norms and things like that. Like, it should be openness and availability to express themselves. If not, you have that oppression coming in, and it translates to the office. Like, if you look at so many different office policies, it probably favors the male. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, or if you look at a lot of political policies, it favors the male. So all of those things can be detrimental if it's unaddressed.
It's really powerful. So masculinity, it's, you know, we shouldn't even talk about it as it being toxic or healthy. It just is. But society's kind of attributed, kind of pushed these stereotypes of what masculinity is, and we've bought into it for centuries, for however many years, and that's kind of what it's become, and that's kind of just perpetuating its own, I guess, toxicity of the message, and we buy into it too. As you know, I think men and women buy into it, right? Because when you say that, one, men buy into it, and like, that's what we want to be. We want to be masculine and trying to do all the masculine things and embody whatever society tells us that is. And I think I also see in a way that women can sometimes contribute to it in a more subtle way, is by the way that they respond or they value some of those stereotypes that are, were just kind of created and kind of sold to us.
I think historically, you know, it has been detrimental too, just from, like I said earlier, that from within the household to the office, it's been detrimental. Even if you look at now, it's a lot of men still have an issue with a woman making more money than them. You know what I'm saying? Like, and those are issues. So, and that's a part of, the man is supposed to have that one step up. The man is supposed to be the head of the household or whatever it is, you know? And again, that is a part of something that was ingrained in society that was passed down, not knowing that women, you know, can work as well and can earn as well. So all of those things should be checked from a societal level, like the view of it, and not keep the two classes between what is masculine, what is feminine, and these specific roles that one should play. It should be a balance between the two and happiness within their collection, you know, whether that's in your personal household or the office setting or the community. Like, all of those things are comprised of healthy relationship and interacting with people, but the lines get blurred when somebody feels like they're more superior or you should be more inferior to them based on this social construct, realistically.
So, okay, so, you know, we're talking about gender roles here. Can you talk a little bit more about how, or what you think about how gender roles impact men's mental health? How does that impact us? Because we can say that, like, right, so like you mentioned, like, there are certain policies and certain things in our society that benefit men over women. And so we can see pretty clearly how things, the patriarchy or whatever, benefits us, right? But I guess I'm curious about how, like, the gender roles and those same things harm us, how they don't serve us.
I would give you this example, right? So I in therapy, I see a lot of men, I see couples, I see children, families, you know, so it's a wide range of people I see within therapy. But the education around certain diagnoses like depression, grief, trauma. So let's just take specifically depression to answer your question. Uh, 200 and some pounds, still views depression as a woman diagnosis. You know what I'm saying? So I've had athletes tell me, yo, I can't be depressed. I had 20 points last night, 7 rebounds. That's for cheerleaders. You know, or I've heard athletes say, you know, male athletes say, nah, in the locker room, I'm good. You know, I had 6 tackles in the game. I got the game ball, whatever the case is. I ain't depressed. I can't be depressed. So that right there is one of the ways that, you know, society has pushed it off to men, not knowing. So the education piece, once it come in, not knowing that depression itself is not a gender diagnosis. Men and women both can be depressed. You know, the symptomology may look different because the added piece of anger and irritability to boys and men. But overall, from a DSM standpoint, the lack of interest and pleasure, the irritable, the hopelessness, the change in appetite, change in sleeping patterns, like all of that criteria is pretty much the same. So when I educate that male within my office, you know, hey, boss, when was the last time you hung with your teammates at that game? You know, how's your appetite? When the last time you had, ate 3 times a day or got 8 hours of sleep? You know, you stand asleep throughout the night, you having issues falling asleep on time, you know, like any thoughts of suicide or self-harm? So when we break it down, they be like, oh, man, you know, bro, now that we know what it is, we can treat it. But if you're running from it thinking that you're this barbaric male and you can't be depressed because that's for women, you know, so, and there's so many other examples of those things. But from an overall standpoint, of course, the vulnerability piece. If I display a certain emotion or if I react a certain way, I'm deemed as less masculine. So now I have to do what I have to do to overcompensate, to let you know that I'm the most masculine person around. And then, of course, that's when the ego comes. That's when the reckless behavior comes. You know, that's being promiscuous. So trying to conquer as many women as I can, or that, you know, substance, you know, I'm putting myself in situations that are deemed reckless, but I got to be the man. So all of those things contribute to your question.
So how do we, I want to know, like, kind of when people are really in that, and, you know, you talked about, you know, athletes, and I assume maybe the athletes, they're people who are maybe already seeking help, or maybe they're getting services through, you know, their team or something. It's not something that they're necessarily seeking out, but, like, I want to know, like, the people who are really, like, the really, like, tough cases, like, how do you, like, what is the, is it just letting them know, like, what the kind of DSM, like, you know, symptoms are, and, like, that snaps most people out of it, like, oh, and that helps people, like, recognize what's going on, like, what is, do people have to generally, like, hit, like, have a rock bottom moment and something big has to happen? Does that have to be a big event? Like, what typically, when people do make this kind of big shift into how they're thinking about mental health, or to even think about mental health, what is that, like, catalyst typically to, like, that pivot moment?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's difficult to group a whole class of people, but, you know, and different people have different resiliency levels, different tolerance levels, and it affects people differently. So, I mean, I've seen men change once, you know, their partner fed up and decide to leave and take the kids or whatever. And I've seen, you know, it happen to when, yo, this is your third job in 2 years. Like, you got to start looking in the mirror. What's going on? You know, or I've seen, like, you know, not being able to handle confrontation without being aggressive or it becoming physical. So, you know, I've seen those people want to, like, yo, hey, I don't know what's going on, but I'm trying to make change. And I've seen people, again, stay in denial, like, oh, it's everybody else. I'm just doing, you know, because realistically, a lot of people are comfortable within that dysfunction. They become numb and desensitized to it because they've been like this forever. You know what I'm saying? It's difficult to tell this 40-year-old man to, hey, you're rubbing a lot of different people the wrong way, when they've been doing that since they were younger because it's been accepted or not addressed for that long. You know, so it all depends on what that person is. So, but, you know, just from a, if it was a diagram standpoint, I would see it go up, and now as far as people acknowledging it, want to change, and then I would see it come down as far as people like, ah, nah, that ain't it. But I would say now that, collectively, I would say that society is doing a better job of marketing and presenting it to people as far as social media or different media personalities and athletes. A lot of different people speaking out about, hey, get your health check, you know, do mindfulness or do calming exercises, do self-care. Like, it's becoming more of a statement. So hopefully it's not a trend. Hopefully it's something that's going to continue to be here. We can continue to normalize it. So more people, specifically men, can feel comfortable enough to say, you know, ain't nothing wrong with me talking to somebody, you know, or, hey, I'm having these thoughts, I need to get them off me, or, bro, I'm just overwhelmed. Like, what can I do? You know? So those things are important, you know? And I think that right there, once that continued to be normalized, a lot of different people would view it as, oh man, I tried therapy, it was dope. Or I've been doing these different interventions that are therapeutic, and I feel better. You know, my relationships are not as cantankerous as they once was. So I'm not as easily upset or hypervigilant as I once was. You know what I'm saying? So once we continue to normalize it, people feel free enough to relieve themselves of those potential issues.
All right, cool. Got it. So let's say we're at the place now that, you know, more people are talking about men's mental health, more people are taking it seriously. It's getting put more out there. So let's say, you know, I'm a man who just recently is like, oh, wait, maybe my mental health is important. Maybe it's something I should pay attention to. Maybe I should see someone. And I'm kind of like in this, you know, I'm in the maybe stage. I want to start, right? I want to start to paying attention to my mental health and learn more emotionally healthy habits. What would be your kind of, what does that look like kind of short term, that practice of mental health look like, right? So that I don't just, I just went to like therapy one time, I kind of liked it, but it's not priority, right? Like, what are the other things? Like, I get, so therapy is one thing. One, are there kind of different kinds of therapies that do you feel like you're, because there's more than just talk therapy, right? Are there different kinds of therapies that you feel like your clients or men in your experience gravitate towards more? One. And two, what are those kind of other practices that, you know, we can start implementing or start trying or looking into so that it becomes more of a daily practice and not just something we do every once in a while and not just the thing that I did so-and-so would get off my back?
Yeah. So I would definitely say one is acknowledging, you know, because again, like if you're not doing it for you or the right reasons, then it's not going to be as important to you. And you might regress back to your old behaviors, or you might just feel like, yeah, this didn't help me at all. But then two, I would definitely say research. And what I mean by that is even if you are seeking different interventions that are therapeutic, they're not going to replace actual therapy. So, but those interventions can definitely be helpful, whether that's you journaling, doing mindfulness exercises, yoga, meditating, listening to white noise, doing art, being creative, doing exercises, you know, so those things are definitely important to reduce your stress. And not only that, but it can increase your overall wellness. So we're talking about a long time ago, people, doctors, therapists, clinicians, a lot of people didn't know that the mind and body was one. They figured it was separate. But now we know, just based off different research, that there are one. So your thoughts can affect your physical health and your mental health and vice versa. So when you look at things like diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, being the number one killer of more African-American men, you know you can get that from your physical health issues, but you also can get that from your mental health issues, such as being hypervigilant, being overstressed, being overwhelmed, depression. All of those things, too, can lead to, you know, so again, physical issues and mental health issues can affect your overall wellness. So that's part of the research, too. But to address your question as far as therapy itself, psychotherapy, which is talk therapy, is a form of therapy that you can do. And while you're doing your research, it's important for you to find a therapist who you feel that you'll connect best with. It's a couple of different videos on my YouTube that address this. It is one on there, What is Therapy? And to be honest with you, most therapists, including myself, offer a free 15-minute consultation just so you can see if you guys are a good fit. Because just because they're a man don't mean that they're going to assist you with different issues. Or just because they are, you know, same ethnicity, that doesn't mean it either. So you have to continue. I would say research about 5 different therapists, you know, and figure out which one of them fit. Don't feel like, oh, man, my insurance company sent me to you, so I got to take. No, you don't. You can do your research. You can definitely find you a therapist that fit, because that's going to assist you in building that rapport and creating that cohesive experience, so that you'll want to stick with it. So it wouldn't feel like, yo, this is not working at all. And when you do get those feelings, if you have a good therapist, it's going to be reassurance there. They're going to help you understand that it's not a process that's going to happen within the first 2 sessions. You got to remember too, like, if you're in your 30s or older, you've been this way for all these years. You want somebody to change within 2 to 3 sessions? That's unrealistic. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Because the first couple sessions, you're building rapport, you're doing intake, you know what I'm saying? So the third session, you got to give me grace and trying to figure out what's going on. So I would definitely say, you know, do the research, pace yourself, but allow the process to be the process. And some I often say on my social media is feel your feelings. So oftentimes men only feel those barbaric feelings. You know what I'm saying? We got to feel all of them. We got to be in rejoice. We got to understand what joy look like. We need to know what happiness feels like, you know, without being demonized for it. So, you know, hopefully that answers your question.
Hmm. I mean, I'm going to, before we wrap up, I want to ask kind of somewhat of a personal question of, for you, what was, you know, one, what was a light bulb moment for you to, you know, start making changes in your own life? Like, was there like a singular like moment or experience that you had that was like, I need to like make the change? And two, this might be 3 questions. Two, what struggles did you encounter on your journey? Like, what kind of obstacles did you find kind of on your way? And how did you overcome those obstacles?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the easiest one is to answer the second one first. Like, it's still obstacles as far as, of course, it's not being normalized. Like, a lot of people still feel that men are supposed to be a certain way, or it's not a lot of access and availability for men, you know, space-wise. And it's still taboo, like, in certain places. And even from a global standpoint, like if you look at places like Cambodia or, you know, just Middle Eastern countries, they still feel that the machismo effect or the macho is what a man's supposed to be. And they not supposed to, you know, alter or display certain emotions or qualities based on those things. And, you know, again, that can be based on tradition, culture, a lot of those norms within those specific societies. So that would be that. But, you know, so those are still barriers, because we still constantly fighting against tradition, religion, and policies. To be honest with you, a lot of things still favor one specific kind of relationship or what should be done based on how it's always been done. So, you know, those barriers are always going to be there. And your first question, as far as my personal journey, you know, like I, like most people, man, like, it's, well, to be honest, not like most people, but I've always grown up in a situation to be able to express my needs and my wants without the fear of what other people might, you know, say or think, you know. So I've just been fortunate, and for me, it was all about strategy and being happy within myself. So a lot of people aren't fulfilled within themselves, so it's easy for them to seek fulfillment in other things. You know, so like I said, like, I was a ward of the state, like, being in a group home with, you know, 10 plus males at any given time, you had to be realistic about, you know, how you want to move. So when I was younger, like, pink became my favorite color just based on strategy. Yeah. So think about it. I'm in a facility with 10 different males. So
right.
All the color schemes were blue, black, green. You know what right. I'm saying?
So, and did you tell them that your favorite color was pink?
Yeah. And it's a story behind it. Every accessory of mine, toothbrush, brush, everything was pretty much pink, and they knew it was mine. And it was on. So we had this. It was one or two residents within in this facility that were now we know intellectually disabled. But back then we just was like, oh man, they'll use your toothbrush, they'll use your brush, no social boundaries or whatever. So, but if you told them, hey, pink is for girls, don't touch it. You know what I'm saying? They ain't touch it. So my stuff is always safe because of that. And then, of course, growing, joined the Army, same thing. It was a lot of blues, blacks, camos, you know, like I'm in an all-male unit, combat engineer. So when stuff get mixed up or missing, I can easily identify my stuff because it's pink. You know what I'm saying? While they're trying to determine, bro, this is black, this is mine, or this camo, this is, no, you know, they ain't write their name on that stuff. So for me, it's always been strategy and just not caring what they would think about it, you know what I'm saying? And then, of course, migrate now with the society. We know pink is for breast cancer and different cancers and stuff like that. So, but I've always been comfortable with who I am to accept what, you know, whatever change I need to make. So me being viewed a certain way or called a certain way didn't really have a impact on how I moved. You know, so I've just been fortunate enough to not only know my boundaries, but enforce my boundaries. So, you know.
Mm. That's, you know, because both those environments, right? And the military, and then also kind of in the group home where there's only males there, you would imagine it's a very kind of machismo kind of environment where they are reinforcing the stereotypes on a daily basis, and maybe even shaming or chastising you for not fitting the stereotypes. And you were able to kind of just be resilient and within your own kind of mind and, you know, be cool with it. There was nothing in your like teenage brain that was like, ah, man, you know, if I just like put away the pink, you know, if I don't wear the pink shirt, then, you know, this girl might like me. Like there's never anything, or there's never anything, you know, they'll stop bothering me if I just. No.
Not that I can remember, man. I know for sure I was embraced by people for just being open and different. And so, you know, like, and for me, I was an athlete and drill teams and stuff like that. And like kickboxing and all that. So I don't think nobody questioned whether I was, you know, soft or feminine or whatever. So for me, it wasn't a part of that. It was just on some, you know, I'm going to do what I want to do. And that was it. You know what I'm saying? So.
And so how do we help children kind of have that resilient mindset of just being themselves unapologetically, right?
Yeah. So that I would say that starts at home with, you know, affirming your children, and then you as a parent not doing those specific gender. Like I got two daughters now, and they would be the first ones to tell you that, oh no, my dad like pink, I'll take the blue, or, you know, whatever, because it's not a situation to where, yo, this is for girls or this is for boys. It's, yo, you're a human, so do what makes you happy. And I remember my youngest daughter was 6 years old, took her to a birthday party, and this lady said it was a paint juice party type thing. And this lady said, all right, the young ladies are going to paint Cinderella, the boys are going to paint these Marvel characters. And my daughter just was confused. She was like, but I want to paint Deadpool. You know what I'm saying? And the lady was like, well, sugar, the girls are going to. So my daughter just didn't understand. So eventually she wound up painting Deadpool in the snow. And then it was crazy. It was like a competition and she won. But a lot of those different things is what I'm saying. So you got to enforce those things within the home setting first. And you have to be, as a parent, open enough to allow your children to explore. Because again, like, it's human qualities, not specific gender roles. My daughters will tell you, they'll be the first person to tell you, like, they witness me cooking. They hear me doing chores and vacuuming loud on Saturday morning. So in future relationships, if a man tell them like, oh, no, that's I'm not doing these chores, that's for women. They're going to know like, no, my dad was loud every Saturday morning vacuuming or, you know, putting stuff away or just taking our sheets or whatever the case is. So, again, like for me, it starts in the home and it starts modeling those, you know, those certain characteristics. But for the other parents, you know, again, it can be those situations to where they still feel that, no, these are for boys. The girls don't play with trucks or army men or whatever, you know, so they got to get out that idealistic view, too. And just make it comfortable for that child, because realistically, children are still developing up until age, of course, 26 or so. So they don't know. Your impact should be greater because they are outside the home way more than they're inside the home. And what I mean by that is they're in the school 8 hours a day. Some of them doing after school, whether it's sports or, you know, just different clubs with school. And then, of course, a lot of them got social media now, too. So if your influence is not as great or it's not as impactful, they can easily drift away based on those things, you know, or gravitating to those things. But I think a lot of parents, too, are ignorant to like just gender identity. They think if they let that boy play with Barbie dolls or kitchen sets or whatever, they're going to be gay. And that's not that's not something that can be proven. And realistically, if you view it, that's those are life skills. He's going to eventually be a father, or he's probably a brother now. So him playing with those toys or, you know, learning to cook at a younger age, like those are, again, life skills, not specifically gender roles, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just think a lot of things have to be groomed differently by not only the societal standpoint, but your specific parenting.
It's not man skills. It's not women skills. It's life skills. It's human skills. Exactly. Right? They're human qualities. I love it. I love it. Great. Okay. One last question. Youngest. So you mentioned you went to therapy when you were young, right? What age were you when you went to therapy?
Yeah. So it was mandatory. I was around 7 or 8.
You were 7 or 8. And do you remember those sessions? Do you feel like that had a big impact on kind of the way that you were seeing things at 7 or 8? Like,
those sessions were terrible. It was no cohesive bond. It was not a collaborative process. So you got to figure, like, I'm this young black kid from the project. You got me in therapy with these old white people. It just was a pleasant experience. And I felt like, yeah, it was just a check in the box. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're here, so you got to go to therapy. Opposed to a collaboration, a cohesive. So now in my therapy sessions, it's collaborative. It's cohesive. I'm identifying with you as a client. You know, we're establishing this thing together, opposed to me dictating a session or making you feel judged or belittled. You know, it's your session. We're collaborating. We're doing this together. We're establishing things together. So for me, it was a poor experience.
Yeah. Big difference when it's me versus you, as opposed to me and you versus the problem, like the whole there different experience. Yeah. So, all right, James, Les, anything else you want to, you know, plug your book, anything else you want to say to the audience before we get out of here and stop recording?
Yeah. So for anybody out there, you definitely can go to my website, www.mentoheal.com, mentoheal.com. You can email me from there if you got specific questions. You can purchase the book from there. It's a good tool for, again, the men in your life. And that can be your sons or your partner. And it's just definitely a great tool. And of course, the board game is on there as well, which is a great tool in your relationships. So you can do that at your adult game night, your couples night, you know, group activity. It's definitely a good icebreaker as well. And then, of course, it's a resource link on my website. So if you do know somebody in need of services, counseling, veterans, it's hotlines on there as well. So, you know, and of course my social media, my contact information is on there. So if you need me, you can get to me from there. And also lastly, my YouTube channel, so many different videos that you probably can benefit from if you have a male in your life who needs assistance. It's a video on men and depression. It's a video on healthy relationships, communication, trauma, trauma bond, you know, parenting styles, attachment styles, just so many different things that people can benefit from. So check that out. That YouTube channel is Men to Heal, but you also can get there from my website, mentoheal.com, www.mentoheal.com.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?